You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
So it's an absolute privilege to kind of continue that theme of bringing together voices for peace, bringing together voices for justice, and bringing the voice of Christian Aid into the Greenbelt occasion. As we hand over to chair your next session, the launch of Time to Act, which is part of the Just Peace Coalition. So we'll be hearing from Christian Aid, we'll be hearing from Embrace the Middle East, we'll be hearing from Sadil Kairos, we'll be hearing from the Amos Trust, and we'll be hearing from the Methodist Church. And to run everything along, it is an absolute joy and a delight to introduce your chair for the next session. He's the head of Church and Community at Christian Aid. It's Pete Murray. Pete, welcome to the stage.
Can you hear me? You can hear me? Amazing. Let me encourage our other amazing panelists to join me on stage today. It's really wonderful to be with you here at Greenbelt. And I am hoping, yes, we are just being joined now online by Richard Saul, who we can see here from St. George's College in Jerusalem, joining us now. Richard, everyone's waving to you here from the field. And hopefully in a second, we will be joined by Munda Isaac, who is also joining us, I think from Ramallah, but Munda can correct us. And I know I was backstage a minute ago talking to both Richard and Munda, so I'm pretty certain that Munda is here. So hopefully he will appear on screen for us in the minute, not least because the format of this session today is going to be that we're going to start by hearing directly from Munda about the situation as he's experiencing it as a Palestinian Christian, and about the Kairos 2 document. We're then going to hear from members of the new Just Peace Coalition, and then we want to have some opportunity to engage with you. I mean, friends, of course, across Palestine and Israel. Ah, Munda, we can now see you on the screen. It's wonderful to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us today. I hope you can see all of our friends in the field waving at you. Do give Munda a wave joining us today. That's wonderful. I mean, we're so conscious, friends, that across Palestine and Israel, communities are living through devastating violence, loss and injustice at the moment. And Palestinian Christians have called on the global church, including us in the UK, to respond not with silence or despair, but with courage, compassion and action. And that's why in June the Just Peace Coalition was launched, which brings together churches and Christian organizations right across the UK to respond to that call. And we're going to hear that call today about why this is more important than ever, about what brought the coalition together, about what the Time to Act campaign is calling for, and how each of us can take action as individuals. As I said, in a minute, we're going to hear from the Reverend Dr. Munda Isaac about the situation in Palestine and the Kairos 2 calls from Palestinian Christians on us. Then we'll hear from our wonderful panelists, and then we'll turn to you to take some Q&A. But first, we are really privileged today to be joined by Munda Isaac. And let me quickly find Munda's CV. Munda is a Palestinian pastor and theologian, the academic dean of Bethlehem Bible College, and is the director of the Christ of the Checkpoint conferences. During the genocide in Gaza, Munda gained global attention for his sermon, Christ Under the Rubble, which was heard by tens of millions of people. And subsequently, it was quoted in South Africa's case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. He is now the pastor at Hope Evangelical Lutheran Church in Ramallah. And you are so welcome, Munda. And we are really keen to hear from you today about the situation and the Kairos 2 call on the global church. Munda, thank you. Let's give Munda a warm welcome, please. Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you. And I hope you can hear me.
Yeah, we can hear you well. Thank you.
Greetings. Good afternoon. And I wish one day I will be in person at Greenbelt. Every time it just doesn't, my schedule doesn't permit, but I truly hope to make it there one day. But thank you, everyone, Christian Aid, everyone who's behind organizing all of this. I see many familiar faces in attendance. So Greetings to everyone I know and I don't know. And I know there you have some Palestinians among you. Muhannad, salamat. And please make sure to get to know Muhannad better if you have the time. I speak to you in very difficult times. And in the short time I have, I would like to, first of all, stress the urgency of the moment. And second, the ask of the Palestinian Christian community. And this will be more or less my outline for today. And to stress the urgency of the moment. Why is this moment different? And why does this moment demand of us an foundationally different response? What we're saying after Gaza, theology after Gaza must be different. Church response after Gaza must be different. Missiology after Gaza must be different. So why is this moment different? And please allow me to give at least five factors, 5 points, why we need a different response. The first is the reality of genocide. The fact that we live in a time in which for more than 2.5 years, there is an ongoing genocide in Gaza. And using terms like genocide is not a choice by Palestinians. We did not coin the definition of what a genocide is not. But in the case of Gaza, the international community pretty much today, when studying the international law, the legal definition, there is a consensus. There is so much an extraordinary body of evidence about what's happening. The United Nations commissions, the different ones, the independent ones, the repertoires, human rights organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Israeli B'Tselem, Medicine Sans Frontiers, the International Association of Genocide Scholars, numerous, and I mean numerous, Israeli and Jewish genocide scholars as well. We all know about the ruling of the ICJ, the arrest warrants by the ICC. In other words, it's not simply a question of whether there is a genocide. Friends, the genocide has not stopped. Even after the ceasefire, close to 1,000 Palestinians have been killed. Yesterday, I was reading about a report which even showed that they're not able to allow watermelon to enter into Gaza. So the reality of genocide compels us, a genocide that we're watching, compels us for a different reflection. To think that we're talking about in the year 2026, we've witnessed the killing of tens of thousands of children, that demands a different response. And I'm not going to even talk about the West Bank, the ethnic cleansing that is happening so far since October 7th, close to 18 communities have been emptied. The violence, everyone is reporting about it. This is the reality demands something different. But the second factor why we need a different response today, the second factor why this moment is different, is that it's not only about the genocide, but it's about the denial and the normalization of the genocide. Friend, this is a genocide that was broadcasted live through television, social media, journalists talked about it, human rights organizations. You know, rarely has a genocide been documented so extensively in real time so that no one can plausibly claim we did not know. Yet despite the unprecedented visibility, genocide denial has persisted. It's still being debated. Despite the growing evidence of report, despite the documents, the studies, some powerful states, in fact, like the United States, have continued to provide military, diplomatic, and political support to Israel while disregarding the legal developments. Several major church bodies have yet to acknowledge fully the reality of genocide in Gaza. In fact, the majority of churches still don't describe the reality as genocide. The third factor is that we failed to prevent a genocide. So I said the fact that there's a genocide, it's being denied, normalized. But third, I think as a humanity and as a people of faith, we have to confront the idea that we failed to prevent a genocide. This failure is significant because the Genocide Convention is not only a convention for the punishment of genocide. That's not the idea. It's not that we study a genocide after it happens and decide whether to punish or not. No, it's fundamentally a convention for its prevention. So the obligation of states is not merely to recognize genocide after it occurred, but to act to prevent it while it is unfolding. For that, we have failed. And I think of the many conferences, the many studies, the many departments, the thousands of scholars around the world who study genocide. Can I say it bluntly? What a waste. What use is it if we have all these bodies, if we have all these legal entities, if we have all these academic studies, and then we fail to prevent a genocide? The fourth factor, and this is especially for a Western audience, is because this genocide is enabled by Western, quote-unquote, democratic states in the West that believe in human rights and in values and so on. This is a genocide that's paid by the West, that's politically enabled by the West. The impunity Israel enjoys and has enjoyed over the years is what led us to this moment. To the day, today, even as we speak about starvation, even as we speak about the denial of letting food and aid enter Gaza freely, as even the peace agreement have said, no one has sanctioned Israel. No one has sanctioned Israel. And today, the United Kingdom, like other countries in Europe and the United States, still enjoy strong financial, economic, military ties with Israel. The fifth and final reason why this demands a response from us is that the theological enabling of genocide. We all know that religious discourse and theology have been used by both Christian and Jewish religious and political leaders to justify, to defend, and in some cases to explicitly call for the destruction of Gaza, or have called the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, which in effect gives green light for all the ethnic cleansing that is happening. Some applied the just war theory and said what Israel is doing is just, is righteous, is an act of self-defense. Let's remember, as Yusuf Al-Khoury, the theologian from Gaza, said, Zionism and Christian Zionist lobby turn biblical stories into a blueprint for genocide and made God its mastermind. They have turned biblical stories into a blueprint for genocide and made God its mastermind. Taken together, all these factors, the reality of genocide, the denial and normalization of it, the fact that we failed to prevent it, the Western enabling of it, the theological enabling of it, means, friends, we cannot do things the same way. Our advocacy, our work for justice cannot be done the same way. Friends, ways of the past did not work. We need to deconstruct the whole system, the whole matrix of theology, and do things afresh. And today, Palestinian Christians are talking about post-Gaza theology or theology after Gaza. And there is a wealth of material that I encourage you to look at, from the books we've written, from the articles, from the videos, or precisely from the Kairos Palestine document, the second document of which I was one of the co-authors. And from that document, I would like to share five important reflections, a roadmap, if you wish, that says, or to the effect of what must change now and how we must go forward. So my following reflections are based on the Kairos Palestine document. I'll be quick. Each one of these points deserves its own unpacking, but please mark them. Number one, it's way due time that churches and faith leaders call things by their name, and we cannot simply tolerate it if they don't. In fact, let me say it, might sound strong, it is actually racism not to. Refusing to name genocide by those who know too well it is a genocide is an assault against our humanity. Because why would you deny genocide? Is it because you don't believe the evidence? Then tell us. Is it because you think all of these reports are fraud and anti-Semitic, even the ones written by Jewish scholars somehow? I don't know. Tell us. Or is it because you don't believe human rights apply to Palestinians? You have to tell us. That's why Kairos 2 speaks with a new clarity and refuses euphemism. We must talk about genocide, ethnic cleansing, the reality of settler colonialism. Friends, please stop talking about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. There is no conflict. We live under apartheid. We need to name things for what they are. We need to even name the misuse of anti-Semitism to silence the Palestinian voice of truth and those who advocate for it. So when you deny reality, whether it's settler colonialism or apartheid or the justice or the genocide, any denial of this reality is an evasion of manifest truth, and it reinforces injustice. Moreover, in Kairos Palestine, we say, and I quote, "We have the right to ask, how can one speak of Christian fellowship or communion while denying, supporting, justifying, or remaining silent before genocide, especially when such acts are committed in the name of God and Scripture?" That's our first point. Language matters. Naming things matter. Second point, Kairos Palestine confronts Zionism and especially Christian Zionism with unprecedented clarity. To us, all of what's happening is a continuation of European colonialism. It's built on racism and ethnic and religious superiority. And when Christians support that, that's Christian Zionism. To us, Christian Zionism is a theological and moral corruption built on racism and ethnic or religious superiority. It's not simply another way of interpreting scripture. I wish it was just let's debate scripture. It's a system of supremacy that must be called out. It's not the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so we're saying, at the same time, even those who claim they're not Christian Zionists but remain silent and go to diplomacy and so on are also complicit in the same way. In Kairos, we say that we're deeply shocked by the position of many churches that adopted the colonizers' narrative or remain silent in the face of genocide, namely churches that condemned the violence of October 7th but remained silent on the violence that came later. This double standard is what shocks us, because we believe all lives are equal. We believe all violence must be condemned, especially against civilians and innocent children. The third point, Kairos Palestine insists on reorienting interfaith, especially Christian-Jewish dialogue, and we do it in a bold and necessary way. To do so, we insist that not every Jew is a Zionist, but not every Zionist is a Jew. And this is crucial, because it opened doors, not for shallow dialogue, but for new alliances rooted in truth. Kairos 2 calls for building relationships with prophetic Jewish voices, those who are risking careers, communities, and security to oppose genocide and confront Zionism. And oftentimes tells us that the church is telling us that we're not good Jews because we're not Zionists. That's why our observation has been that in many ways, Christian-Jewish dialogue has turned into a Christian-Zionist dialogue. And when it is such, we must boycott it, call it out. We cannot normalize injustice. And so we say in the document, we call on the churches of the world to distinguish between dialogue with Jews and dialogue with Zionism. Indeed, to boycott dialogue with Zionist voices that have supported and continue to support occupation, apartheid, and the genocide of the Palestinian people. And as I said, instead to create interfaith alliances with the prophetic, the rising, the many numbers of Jewish voices around the world who are for justice. Number four, Kairos 2 renews its call, the call for creative nonviolent resistance that is rooted in the logic of love. Friends, boycotting is an ethical choice. We cannot normalize genocide. We cannot. Boycotting is an ethical choice. We cannot remain silent. forms of sanctions, calling for sanctions, calling to boycott, is an ethical choice. And that's the message of Kairos Palestine. We call upon all people in the document, believers from every faith and persons of convictions, to create alliances, grassroots movements that calls for arms embargo, prosecution of war criminals, reparations and sanctions. For we cannot live in a world in which a genocide is normalized. And finally, we renew the global call to sustain the Christian presence in the Holy Land, because right now it's our survival that it is at stake. Help us stay, help us build, help us even rebuild Gaza. We haven't lost hope. This must become now a priority, for the Holy Land cannot turn into a museum of old churches. We renew the call to come and see, stand in solidarity. Solidarity is costly. This is the time to come and stand with solidarity. This is the time to challenge the siege that is imposed on the Christians of the Holy Land as part of the Palestinian people. So come and live the living stones, whether in Beit Sahur, in Taiba, where settlements are suffocating our lives, or even in Bir Zeit and Abud. And we're grateful that many churches are doing great work for justice. We're grateful for your work. And with that, I would like to remind you that when we, the world, decided to say never again, it should be never again to all peoples. We failed. We failed to protect the Palestinians. And this is not about the past tense, for the genocide has not ended. Recognizing that, let's break from the ways of the past and move forward with a new prophetic courage and costly solidarity, and stand for justice. Thank you.
Munda, thank you. Thank you so much. That was incredibly sobering, but also, a really powerful call on us that, as you say, we must respond to. Before I bring our friends on the panel in, I wanted to bring in Richard Sewell. Richard is the Dean of St. George's College in Jerusalem. We're really grateful, Richard, that you can join us here today as well. Richard, we've listened to that call from Munda, and I think Munda representing Palestinian Christians more widely through the Kairos 2 document. And I guess one of the things I'm reflecting on is, this is a call on the global church. Why is it that the UK church should respond? I mean, what power do we have as the church? What does it matter that we do anything as the church specifically?
Hi, everybody. Thanks, Pete. Good to see everybody there. And thanks. Steadfast engagement with this, maybe in a bit of drizzle at Greenbelt and all the other work that everyone is doing. It matters what you do and what the UK government does, actually, because it matters what everybody does. If everybody says, well, yeah, but what can I do? And if every country says, other than America, well, what we do, what policies we enact doesn't actually make the difference, then nothing happens. And it's a teaching of powerlessness. Whereas what we have to believe is that every act and every word either bolsters oppression or helps to challenge it. And no one action of one person or one policy of one government, with the possible exception of America, actually will make the difference. But we can't give up. And I sometimes hear people say, when there is a prospect of the UK doing something, it's too little, too late. And it honestly really annoys me, because it's a sort of council of despair. Because it's like, well, let's not bother then. If it's too little, too late, there's nothing else we can do. And if we're going to do anything, it's going to be incremental. Because there's not going to be a revolution tomorrow that suddenly liberates Palestine. It's going to be step by step. Now, let's make those steps faster. But let's all continue to do our bit. And the UK has not relented. Individuals, churches, often too quietly, often too slowly, but it, the individuals have been the ones that have driven it, and we must continue to drive it. Why else does it matter? Because we have been directly asked to get involved and to make our voice heard and to put to make costly sacrifices for the sake of our Palestinian brothers and sisters. So we're being directly asked, and therefore we are obligated. And also it matters because the UK is enmeshed in the whole situation, actually in a way that no other country is, because of the British mandate from 1917 to 1948, that we directly contributed more than any other country to the creation of the utter mess that has caused the occupation and has caused ethnic cleansing and ultimately led to the genocide. And the situation is advancing faster and faster today and in the days to come. So it also matters because of the absolute urgency that there is no time to lose. And actually, although, you know, we're a relatively small country and we, compared to the great powers, we're relatively small, what the UK says is heard. And if we lead the way, wouldn't that be a wonderful thing? Others, it will help others to follow. And it's about momentum. So individuals, churches, institutions, governments, all of us cannot relent, must not relent, must actually step up our actions now because the clock is ticking.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you. I'm going to come to, on my far left, quite right on my far left, yeah, Dave Hardman is the Methodist Liaison Officer for Jerusalem. Most of his time spent in Jerusalem. Always a privilege to have Dave here with us in the field. A lot of us, Dave, have been campaigning on this for years. I mean, lots of us for decades, but particularly since October the 7th, lots and lots of campaigning. So why this coalition right now?
Yeah, and I think we should acknowledge those people who have been committed to campaigning for justice in Palestine for generations. And it's not that we're saying, oh, we're about to do this, we're about to bring people together and that will be it. What we're doing is building on what has gone before. But the coalition came about because we started to talk about having Christian organizations and churches uniting to do something during the week of prayer for peace in Palestine and Israel. But the truth is, and I hear colleagues, my friends in Palestine who say, quite frankly, if all you're going to do is pray, don't. Because actually we need your action. I have people when we bring groups through the Methodist Liaison Office, and they say to me, are you just bringing a group to listen to our story again, and what they're going to do about it? The time has passed for pretty prayers. The time has passed for visiting and then doing nothing with these stories. The time has come to act. The time has come not only to share the stories, but to demand that we don't hear them again. And so as a group of Christian organizations and churches, we decided that it was the time to act. But I also believe that it is a really good time because the genocide, the apartheid, the settler colonialism that we're seeing now, that Mumtha talked about as being, you know, televised, actually, we know what's happening and we cannot ignore it. And people know what is happening. So we need to build on that, to build that campaign. We're not quite at the arc where we're going to get over it and we're going to see justice tomorrow. But it's our duty as churches to challenge the empires and the powers that exist so that we keep pushing up the hill to one day we celebrate a free Palestine.
Dave, thank you. I want to kind of dig into the campaign a bit. That's the kind of background to the coalition. David Thompson is the chief exec of All We Can, another member of the Just Peace Coalition. Tell us a little bit, David, about, okay, so that's the coalition. So actually, what are we trying to achieve with this campaign? What's Time to Act trying to do that's different from what we've done before?
Right.
So in many ways, it's trying to bring us together and not working individually in different parts, because we are more powerful together on this. And the campaign is then allowing us to bring the information, the resources that enable churches and individuals to act. It's about taking action, as we've heard. It's about engaging. And it's about costly solidarity, as Munta has called us to. So there are opportunities within the campaign. It's about listening. It's about learning, it's about living, and it's about acting. So whether you are new to the issue, new to campaigning, it's for you. Whether you are well-versed in it, and I see lots of T-shirts that say you are, then it's for you also, because it's about bringing us together with all the richness of lived experience that we have of campaigning as churches in the UK. The listening is really simple. It's read, study, engage. Read about and listen to the calls of Palestinian Christians. And there's something really interesting. Through listening, we move towards solidarity. We can't do it without that. And so the listening part is really key for us. And sadly, Palestinian Christians, if you think even back over the last two decades, have been shouting at us to listen. And now we are at Kairos too, because we haven't been listening. So the call for us is to listen. The call for us is to learn as well. Let's educate ourselves on the issues. Let us pray, let us worship, let us use the study materials that the campaign have produced. It'll help deepen our understanding. It'll help equip ourselves, because it's scary sometimes going into conversations with people about it. So we'll be better equipped for that as individuals and as our churches. And it will show and witness a faithful response. Part of that, of course, is us lamenting. It is about repenting. Part of that is repenting of theology that has been used against Palestinians. It's about living, about ethical choices. We've heard that before, we've heard it in different places. It's about what we buy in the supermarkets. It's about what companies we support. It's about where our churches invest. We need to make ethical choices that affect our lifestyle and the practice of our churches. And finally, we need to act, and we've been hearing about that. The demand for the campaign to show real action. And it's about political change that is necessary. It is about our government changing its position. It is about Christian institutions being engaged with politics to create that change and to push for that change. And as we said, it's collective action together.
Great. Thank you, David. Let's get into that political action bit. Gloria, I'm really sorry if I'm going to say your surname wrong. Lachese Debney? I got it wrong. Gloria is Advocacy and Campaigns Manager, Embrace the Middle East. You do advocacy. That's what that's what you're into. Talking about that political action, what are we actually asking here for? What are the policy asks as part of this campaign?
Thank you, Pete. Can you hear me? Yeah, all right. Well, obviously the campaign exists because we want to see actual change and impact on the ground. Otherwise, there's no point in coming together running a campaign. So how do we do that? Is David said it, Richard said it, we have to influence those who are in a position of power to make that change happen. In our case, that's our UK government. I think I'm kind if I say that they've done next to zero. Until now, they've used a lot of very strong words, but actually they've taken really no real action to address the situation on the ground. So our umbrella theme for all of our political asks of the campaign is that we want the UK government to pressure Israel, to actually pressure Israel into ending their illegal occupation of Palestine. Otherwise, there's not going to be any peace, any just peace in the land. So how do they do that? Well, our asks, just because the UK has been doing basically nothing about this, are just a starting point. So we want to start from having the UK government exercising economic pressure on Israel to end the occupation. Right now, Israel is running a free of charge occupation, and actually they're profiting from it. So how can they do that? Banning trade with settlements is a basic. Suspending the UK-Israel preferential trade agreement is another one of those. How else can they pressure Israel? Stop selling arms to Israel. That's another one of our asks. Very simple, apparently complicated and impossible to enact. We're also asking the UK government to impose sanctions on all of those Israeli politicians, ministers, high-level officials who are actively inciting to violence against Palestinians or are responsible for severe human rights violations and international crimes against Palestinians. We've got a great sanctions regime. It can be used. They've done a little bit of it. Not enough, they have to do more of it. And then last one is actually engaging and collaborating with those international accountability bodies. We're talking about the International Criminal Court, the International Court of Justice, who are investigating international crimes, human rights violations that Israel has perpetrated, and not just Israel, also Hamas, and they've got to actively cooperate with them. And if I may add one last thing, one of the ways they can do that, very basic one again, which they haven't done, is responding to the ICJ advisory opinion of 2024, which declares the occupation to be illegal. The UK is still carefully considering this very important document, so complex to respond to. So this is the excuse they've been using for 2 years. It's time to stop.
Gloria, thank you. I'm going to come to Lynn, and then we're going to have an opportunity for you to ask questions. Loads of actions there that Gloria talked us through. People in this field here today will have done a lot over the last few years, but Lynn McAllister is a board member at Sabil Kairos, another great member of the coalition. What is it that we can do today?
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I'm just going to make a few suggestions that what we can do after we leave Greenbelt. And the first one is an obvious one. It's become familiar with Kairos to Palestine. It is the call from the Palestinians to us as Christians and to us in our churches. So the Kairos Palestine is online on the Just Peace Coalition. It's also in a booklet form, which some of you might have seen already. This booklet form is lovely. And Sliman Mansour, a Palestinian artist, donated his paintings to it. So I'd recommend, I think Claire's going to got them for afterwards. After you've familiarised yourself with it, my suggestion is that you give it to your church leader or or people who are in leadership in your churches and ask them to read it. It's quite a non-confrontational way of bringing this Palestine into your conversation. I would also say arrange to have a meeting with them after they've read it to see what your church could do to respond to this call. And you're not saying anything out of kilter, because the Church of England, the Methodist Church and the URC have also made sort of top line supportive statements. So that's two things. Three, there's a study guide, so you could lead or have a study in your church, maybe either at Lent or Advent. The study guide is also on the Just Peace Coalition website. And we have actually led a study, one study at Sabil Kairos. And we're going to train, if you're potentially interested in having a study of Kairos 2, we're going to have a training session. And Claire's got the sign-up sheet for that. The other thing is that there's liturgical resources on the Just Peace Coalition website, so you could use those in your church service. And Sabil Kairos has also done a full-length service that you could use all or part of it within your church. And lastly, like other people have said, It's looking at boycotting services and goods that support the occupation. And there's a little business card that Claire's also got that will help you to do that. But it's not only about avoiding buying Israeli products, it's about supporting the Palestinian economy by buying their products. And Embrace the Middle East have got lots of lovely Palestinian products on their stall, including Christmas cards and crockery and olive oil. But I just want to say that one thing I've done in my church is I've asked if I could sell Zaytoun products, and I sell them once a month after the church service. And this goes, it's really good because it obviously buys the goods, so that's helpful for the Palestinians. It keeps the issue of Palestine alive. And also people often give me donations on top of what they're buying, which I give to a Palestinian charity. So if you want to know anything more about that, if you fancy doing that, come and have a word with me afterwards.
Lynn, thank you. Brilliant. Can we give all of our panellists, Amantha and Richard, a round of applause again? Thank you so much. Thank you as well for bearing with us during the rain. It's really good to see so many of you here today. We would love to hear some questions from you now. We've got about 15 minutes, I think, for questions. Callum is wandering around with the mic. I think, Callum, I'll take three in one go, if that's all right. Yeah, go for it. Oh, and if we could have just two things, if we could have questions rather than statements, and also just a reminder that this is being recorded. So if you don't want to be recorded asking your question, I'm afraid don't ask a question during this time. So yeah, great.
Hi, Rowena here from Embrace. Thank you all for what you shared, and really good to see you both, Mantha and Richard. Many of us know that there was a change in the wording to the motion at General Synod regarding Kairos 2. And my question was really about the wording in the Kairos document. And I'm sure that most of us here at Greenbelt would agree with everything that you've shared and some of the terms that we've used. But my question is about some of us who want to share, particularly with churches who may not be as comfortable with terms such as genocide, ethnic cleansing, apartheid, but who are open, but maybe earlier on in their journey, if we have limited time to share with them, how would we approach those kind of conversations?
Rowena, thank you. Brilliant. Let's have one more question. I think the mic is just coming to you, sir. Yeah, great.
Just quick question, understatement.
Statement, please.
Is the Catholic Church involved in this Kairos 2? And the lectionary beginning of October gives us an ideal resource. Isaiah 5, 1-7 is the reading. It was the reading in 3 years ago. It's coming up again this year. Please use it.
Great. Thank you. One final question. Callum, yeah, do you want to come down here towards the front?
Mike Minuterth with the Iona community.
Great.
Could I check if the World Week for Peace for Palestine and Israel is coming up? Because that might be an opportunity to focus our work in our churches.
Great, thank you. Thank you for those questions. Munda and Richard, maybe if I could come to you first, because we're so privileged to have you here with us today. On that question around how we talk about genocide and ethnic cleansing, I guess in our churches, particularly with people who might be new to this issue or feel a lack of confidence in understanding or talking about this, you know, do you have any prompts for us on how we start to kind of broach those conversations in our churches? Munda?
Yes. It's a question of whether the international law and human rights matter anymore or not. If they don't want to engage in this, then why not for Russia to take the whole of Ukraine or for Trump to take Greenland and call it Trump land? It's okay. Why not? And why not for, you know, children to be massacred in Somalia and anywhere? Is that our position? Do we really think that human rights no longer matter and the international law no longer matters? So that's the first question. The second thing is the evidence. Look at how many reports. And so anybody who doesn't want to engage with the question, ask them, are you saying that all of these reports are fraud? Seriously? I mean, are you in a position, and to be honest, when a church leader tells me that, to me, it also conveys arrogance. Who are you to tell all these experts and international leaders, organizations and Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem and Amnesty and the experts, and that they don't know nothing, and only you, the pastor, know that it is not a genocide? I mean, it puts us as Christians in a place of arrogance and condescension. So the evidence is there. It's a question, why is it being denied? Why is a genocide, despite the evidence, despite the fact that the international law is very clear, why is it being denied? That's how I would approach it. And just to quickly say, Kairos too has many Catholics in it. The chair of our board is the previous patriarch, the patriarch emeritus of the Catholic Church. We have a Catholic priest with us. We have other Catholic secular leaders with us. It's an ecumenical group par excellence.
Wonderful. Thank you. Richard, you know, you also know the reality of being a vicar in a church in the UK, sometimes having to talk about seemingly difficult things. I mean, maybe we shouldn't talk about this in that kind of way, but you know what I mean. Do you have any advice for us sat here in churches who might feel that, like, this is these are difficult topics to broach?
Yeah, you know, I think it's best not to get into an argument about individual words, but to listen to the weight of the voice of Kairos 2 as a whole. You know, people can always just reject all of it by saying, well, it's not genocide because of one factor that they've decided makes the difference. And you can just end up in a to and fro about that one single word. Whereas if they engage with the whole of the document, it has a weight of persuasion about a whole orientation of the assault on Palestinian life in numerous ways, in the way it has been justified in theological terms or by a complete hands-off non-engagement. And so maybe not to go full in on, you know, do you think it's genocide or not, but to go, what do you think about the voices that you're hearing through these and on a much wider scale.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, no, go on. Sorry.
You know, and there is so much more to it than just the decision about a word.
Yeah.
And I think engaging in the breadth and the depth of the entirety of the experience of these last 75 years is really important.
Thank you. I was just going to turn to the panel on kind of UK Catholic Church involvement. What does that look like, David?
Yeah. So it's a great question, and I think that what's really encouraging, CAFOD is a member of the Just Peace Coalition, and if you go onto the website, you will also see bishops from the Catholic Church endorsing the campaign. So there's a strong support for that, and I think then you followed on with a piece about thinking about our lectionaries, thinking about the cycles, the calendar in our churches, and really work at when are good moments to bring that in. And the Iona community is also part of the coalition. And so if you have ideas, please write into the coalition, send in those ideas, because that's, you know, we're doing this together. It's not a bunch of the agencies and churches alone. Bring your ideas to us, please.
Great. And the World Week for Peace, has anyone got thoughts on that? Is that an opportunity we could be using this year? Everyone's looking at Dave, so go on, Dave.
Yes.
All right. Three more quick questions I think we have time for. I can see hands. Yeah, great. Callum, if you could run over.
With the World for Peace, I think it's also important to follow the final resolutions from the World Council of Churches, which name apartheid.
Yeah.
So, because this is an initiative of the World Council of Churches, yeah. So this can actually give more strength to, you know, because now it's acknowledged within WCC circles that Israel is committing apartheid, not the genocide question yet, but at least apartheid.
That's really helpful, because that gives us greater legitimacy that the World Council of Churches also has made that statement. Thank you, Munda. Yes.
I think it's really important to recognise that in much of the media and in our churches, there is specifically racism directed at Palestinians, anti-Palestinian racism. And it's very hard to get churches to recognise that and to address it. And it would be really helpful to have resources that will help us to tackle it when we come across it, because it is really invidious.
Right, thank you. Thank you. Another question here, Callum.
Thank you. I'm in the inner city, and at Christmas Eve, I was given permission to focus on Bethlehem and the issues around the West Bank as part of that, well, during the midnight mass. It's a very small church in the middle of a housing estate, and everything was fine until I suggested copying actually Wunther's wonderful image of the baby in the rubble. We've got all the stuff prepared, but because there was somebody in the congregation who had incredible personal stuff that had gone on that could have been triggered by it, that I was stopped from doing that. Now, this isn't a very cerebral sort of place. Lots of words wouldn't have cut it. It was the image that I thought would actually get through. I used a video, but I wasn't allowed to... Well, I could have fought it, but Christmas Right. Eve wasn't the time to do it. But I just wondered if you've got any comments about how you handle somebody who's in a situation of social justice, in actually a church that isn't racist, has got a huge a range of different races in it, but actually has very severe social issues and personal issues going on for people. How do we portray the reality? Because it actually triggers so much in
Great.
Them.
Thank you. One final question, Callum. Thank you. Great.
Yes. Is this on?
We can hear you.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes. I was listening yesterday to the Reverend Sue Parfitt. She told us that the issue of Gaza and the settler colonialists in the West Bank is the defining moral question of our day. And in particular, as our country has so much responsibility for what's happened there, firstly with the Balfour Declaration,
yeah.
then withdrawing from the British mandate to allow the Stern Gang to take over the Palestinian land in the Nakba, that each and every church in this country has not come out in favour of the Palestinian who are Christians. I cannot understand it. Can you please explain it to me?
Okay. Great. We're going to have quick questions, quick answers to those questions. Let me start with that question. Actually, Richard, if I could come back to you about that question about being triggered, because I've sort of heard you talk about that a little bit before, about people saying, you know, challenging you. I feel you're looking blankly at me about being triggered sometimes when you raise these issues. And I've heard you talk quite powerfully about sort of saying, you know, like how do we act with and speak boldly and use imagery like this when people can kind of challenge us in that way?
Well, yeah, you know, I think we have to be sensitive to what's happening locally, and you can't just absolutely run roughshod and without knowing the specifics of the case that lady mentions, hard to say. But I would have thought that triggering actually builds empathy, you know, and talking about people in a traumatized situation is something, it's acknowledging the human vulnerability. And I'd hope that we don't have to avoid talking about any situation of any great need in any part of the world, because there are other people in the church who are feeling vulnerable. That's as a broad principle. And I think it's about trying to find ways of building human empathy and strength and solidarity together so that people who are under the cosh understand even better what it means to be under the cosh in another place, and drawing those parallels and saying we're not trying to do down anybody's own personal trauma, but we're trying to focus on anywhere where we can help to make a difference.
Great, thank you, Richard. Lynn, you talked really well about the different resources that are available. That question about racism directed at Palestinians, and are there any resources on that? You know, I'm just interested in your, if you have any thoughts on whether there are things that can be produced in that space. What do we do with regard to that?
I actually don't know of any resources at the moment.
Others on the panel got any thoughts on that question?
I think she was suggesting that
we haven't got them,
so we need them.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know if thoughts from these range of organisations about whether and how we could do that. Interested in views on that.
Just very quickly, Sabil in Palestine did produce a book on anti-Semitism, which also talks about anti-Palestinianism. And I can't remember the title of the book, but actually that might be a good place to start.
Great, thank you. Before, I want to give Munda the final word, if that's okay. But that kind of challenge around, like, you know, why is it that the church hasn't responded? Gloria, because you haven't had a chance to respond to a question. I'm interested in your reflection on behalf of Embrace the Middle East, really important partner here. And then Munda, maybe if I give you the final word on that question, you know, what is it that means that it's taken us so long? Why aren't we responding, as the gentleman said, on, you know, defining moral question of our day? But Gloria, and then I'll come to Munda on that.
A simple and complex answer at the same time. This is a very sensitive topic, unfortunately, for many reasons. People are afraid of being labelled as anti-Semitic. People have grown up and have been surrounded by the wrong theologies. And when that's ingrained in you and you hear the same for years and years, it's really, really hard to challenge your own systems and what everyone around you, your own family, believes. So it is something that's very sensitive. It doesn't mean that it can be approached. And actually, I believe Embrace and Christian Aid as well, we've got some great resources to introduce the topic in your churches in a sensitive way, in a gracious way. So if you come to our stand, we've got gracious dialogue. I think, Pete, your resource is called the Just Peace.
Yeah.
So there's things that can help approach these kind of topics, but unfortunately it is a sensitive issue.
Thank you, Gloria. Munda, 1 minute, if you're able, just to give us a kind of a response on that, I know, and like a call to action as we go out from this field today would just be really wonderful. Sorry to drop that on you.
I'll try to be quick. I think in addition to what was mentioned, I think many times we have Christians adopt the positions of their culture, of their governments, of their society. And that's why we were shocked when churches were repeating statements that looked as if it's your prime minister actually speaking, not the archbishop or the pastor or the theologian. So rather than the church being the conscious of the world and authorities and empire, the church is in line with the empire it's part of. Second, and it has been mentioned, Christian Zionism. Let's keep mentioning it. Christian Zionism is a challenge. It's corruption. We need to challenge it. Fear of anti-Semitism, that's true, and anti-Semitism is real. It must be challenged, but we must also challenge the weaponization of anti-Semitism. We must have the courage, examine ourselves, examine our motivations, study anti-Semitism, to be aware that what we're saying isn't perceived as hatred to Jews. We need to be careful, but then we shouldn't be paralyzed. But then there is another issue of false concept of peacemaking. Friends, we think of peacemaking as neutrality, and that's a challenge. Peacemaking means taking sides, speaking truth to power. Peacemaking means creative resistance, nonviolence. It's not simply about being neutral or pacifist. And finally, I think that's a challenge, and let's face it, that many pockets in our churches have the sin of apathy, indifference. We look at the person in the road between Jerusalem and Jericho, which is my sermon today. We look at that person and we say, what a pity, and continue moving. We move on to our conferences. We move on to our theological circles. We make judgments. We say we don't want to engage in politics. This has nothing to do with us. And we continue moving on. Maybe we don't want to engage in controversial issues. We don't want to trigger issues. And we end up being exactly like those two religious leaders who looked and did nothing.
Thank you. Friends, thank you so much for joining us today, for being part of this session. Please, let's give another warm thank you, particularly to Munda and to Richard for joining us today from Ramallah and Jerusalem. To Dave Hardman from the Methodist Church, Gloria from Embrace the Middle East, David Thompson from All We Can, and Lynn McAllister from Sabil Kairos. These are just a few of the members of the Just Peace Coalition. There are many others. Before you leave, I just want to give you some things to do. Sign up to the campaign. There are postcards. Everyone should have received a postcard in your communion bag today. Please sign up to it. There's a QR code as well that you can use. Take postcards back to your churches and encourage people in your churches to get involved. Write to your MPs. There are resources on the ACT part of the Just Peace website, which you can visit. There's a letter there about settlement trade and about the proposed new settlement in Bear Sahur, which would be great if you could sign. Promote this on your social media. There's going to be a big event in Liverpool around the Labour Party conference on Sunday, the 27th of September. If you are in Liverpool or the surrounding area, we would love you to join us there. There'll be a walk of witness. There'll be a service. And Dayed Nassar from Tent of Nations is going to join us at that as well. And, you know, with the Labour Party meeting, it'll be great for us to have such a demonstration of strength at that. So if you can get to Liverpool on the 27th of September, we would love to see you there. Munda wanted me to mention as well that in Belfast in November, the 13th of November onwards, there is a Church at the Crossroads conference. This is building on Christ at the Checkpoint conferences that he's held. So if you are able to get to Belfast, that will be a really, really powerful conference in November. And I think there might be ecumenical accompaniers in the field as well. If you are... and yes, there's someone standing up. If there is anyone who's been involved in IAPI and you would like to find out more about that, Cheryl here has just stood up and would love to talk to you about that. I think there are probably others. Do find out about that work as well, because that is a really, really valuable part of this. I think the final thing I want to say is, I know I can imagine most of you in this field have done a huge amount on this issue for a long, long time. And I guess the thing that I really, really want to urge you to do, if you can do one more thing, is to take this back into your churches. Have those seemingly difficult conversations. Encourage others to get involved. This is, you know, we've heard it so clearly today. This is a time to act. We need to act. I know so many of you have, but it's a time for us to take this back to others and to encourage and urge them to listen to what we're hearing today and to do what they can, and for the UK church to really stand up in a new way on this issue. So thank you so much for being part of this, and I really look forward to us working with you today. And yeah, let's send one final wave and applause back to Muntha and Richard. Thank you so much, friends. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone at No Fly Zone. Can we have another great big round of applause for everyone who's been here together?
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.